Well, Lord Hill, I think one of the things that comes across from your writings on this question is that you speak very well of the possibility that actually the National Health Service in its origins is almost a doctor's creation. And in other words, the model that might be in people's minds where the great battles between the BMA and others seems to be not altogether accurate. And if you could just talk a little about the 20s and the period after that, about the history of doctors' feelings about state intervention.
Well, of course, before our time, there were the great battles with David Lloyd George and the National Health Service, the panel service, for workers within a certain income limit or wage earners only, and not for dependents and not for consultant service. That had worked after the appalling rows that one read of. That worked. And the doctors' feeling between the wars that while it was good, it was not enough. Then they put forward their proposals based on the old panel service to extend to dependents and to consultant service. But what they didn't yield or want was it to be open for the whole community. Well, 1942, of course, was the crucial year. The doctors, BMA and the Royal Colleges, had set up the Medical Planning Commission. Looking back, although I was on the staff of the association at the time, I'm not quite sure why. There's this vague feeling in wartime that the world won't be and ought not to be the same again. I suppose it was also the feeling that if they didn't produce a plan, someone else would. Well, they set up the Medical Planning Commission. It was, looking back, its interim report, it never made a final one, but its interim report is really remarkable. It yields the 100% principle that the service should be open to the whole community. He yielded that. Oh, there were frills, health centres, payment of doctors in part by salary. The remarkable thing was that that happened in 1942. Well, then, later that year, Beveridge. The medical service was only incidental. But if you were going to provide a social security service for the whole community, then you make an assumption, and they made an assumption, Assumption B it was called, that it would be open to the whole community. So those two events, in the end, introduced with some success, it didn't last permanently, for the 100% principle. But then towards the latter part of the war, as you know, there came these various proposals. That abortive one by the National Liberal Minister Ernest Brown. I'm in some difficulty. If it had been 50 years ago, I should have remembered it. But at 30, I'm a little weak. Well, that was shot down in no time. Then came Willink, too nice a man ever to be in politics. And the proposals of Willink were not at all bad and not at all unacceptable to the profession. But the trouble was that we as a profession turned down a particular proposal as wholly objectionable. Then when that was withdrawn, we found another one to find wholly objectionable. I think the profession was suddenly realized that all the talk of their own talk and the talk of others about a National Health Service was coming closer to action. It was like taking a cold bath early in the morning. And then, of course, came Nye.
That brings us to the interesting question in a way, which is that I think in the general historical imagination, that is then seen as a battleground, a period which has been relatively quiet, as it were. There have been agreements and proposals and discussion between apparently unlikely bedfellows, as it were, now turns into something more bitter, and we have a sense of the period in the mid-40s as being aggressive and unpleasant. I mean, what were the details of this alteration of mood?
To answer that question, one must recall Nye's reputation at the time. The squalid nuisance as described by Winston Churchill. The man who dared to challenge his strategic concepts of the war. The man who deliberately got himself out on a limb. I'm not going to make any parallels between then and today, but it's the more easily understood if I say that he had got himself out on a limb with most people. He was the best parliamentarian of his day, they all knew that. But they'd no idea of this man being a constructive thinker in a field in which he'd said nothing, that of the health service. So, not surprisingly, the profession was astonished, many were shocked, some were disgusted. In that, they were doing, I think, no more than the general community was doing or feeling. But bit by bit, that faded. There were certain things about him. He never said, "I'll think about that," when he meant he was going to reject it. He rejected it. You knew where you stood in those early days. But there are two main fears that I think tend to be forgotten. Between the wars, the relationship between the public health service, the medical officer of health, and all that, local authorities, and the profession was pretty poor. And they had a terrible fear that now that local government had become a hospital authority, as it had in 1930, and had its own hospitals, the voluntary hospitals would be handed over to local government. That's what they had reason to fear. After all, Herbert Morrison was a powerful member of that government. He was first and foremost a local government, local authority man. And then they learnt, I'm carrying it forward a bit now, but then they learnt, to their surprise and delight, that he didn't propose. He'd fought and beaten Herbert Morrison on that basic proposal. Decided to create a new and separate hospital organisation. That did him a great deal of good with the consultants.
So in some sense, your image of Bevan, and it comes across in your autobiography, is that he ends up in some serious sense as the friend to the doctors.
He, of course, if he were here, would be the first, and with vigour and language which you couldn't put into this programme, to deny it.
Yes.
But he was a sensitive man. After all, he had another achievement. We hear nowadays about parties adhering to manifestos. Wasn't so common in those days, but a whole-time salaried service of the state was in the Labour manifesto for the 45 election, which they won. And that engaged the attention not only of the consultants, but the profession as a whole. A whole-time salaried service. Well, Nye produced neither a local government hospital service or a whole-time salaried service. I'm not suggesting that hats were thrown in the air. They weren't. It took the doctors a long time to appreciate the importance of those two political decisions. After all, the doctors were worried about other things. They were no longer worried, I think, about the right to choose your own doctor, which would have disappeared with a salaried service. But they were worried, well, looking back, I suppose, I may have been unduly worried about it. Loss of the right to sell their practices. I was astonished to find it described as something utterly immoral. Something that many professions have done for generations and still do, for they do no more than sell the right of access to those patients. But then we ran into a good deal of other difficulty. I think, looking back, we didn't sufficiently appreciate the importance of those two steps, those two reversals of his own party's policy by Nye Bevan.
So Bevan, in some way, one of the important contributions he made to the foundation of this service is that he didn't stick to the manifesto,
no.
Withdrew at a crucial point, and hence
yes,
befriended the profession in that way.
Well, yes, but of course he... What Bevan couldn't forget... his political stance, his political habits, his political oratory, and so on. I remember he described the tones, but not the dulcet tones. God, it was the opposite of dulcet tones of the profession in a speech in the House of Commons. He was hitting straight at me, who by then had become the secretary of the BMA. Silly stuff. But it had to be, and I had to indulge in a great deal of superb oratory. I mean, that was the snag about it.
But behind which there seems to be a very distinct and rather sort of hard-headed bargain being struck between the two main groups involved, i.e., as it were, the state and the profession of medicine. Which leads to another question. How important do you think, the question in two halves, how important do you think from your experience the Socialist Medical Association was as a political pressure group of a socialist kind? And what about the TUC? Taking the SMA first, I mean, did Bevan listen to them? Do you think?
No. It was a relatively small body. Stark Murray and Horace Jules, two able people, both friends of mine. It was a small group. It played a very little part in the... It wasn't, I think, represented in the House of Commons. It played very little part in the whole business. No.
So not relatively unimportant, then. What about the TUC, which seems, in ways again you've discussed, to be very interestingly in tandem with BMA positions in rather unlikely ways, particularly during the late 30s. What's the story there? I mean, it's an unlikely alliance.
I'm just trying to think why, in fact, we formed the Joint Committee in the first place. It may have been in connection with industrial medicine. I don't now recall, but I do know that it played no part as a TUC. The component parts were the government and the doctors.
That's most interesting and leads one on perhaps to some reflections on the history of the service in the subsequent years. How do you see, starting at the wrong end in a way, but given that it continues to seem in difficulties, particularly through financial problems, how do you feel that in some way one might reflect on these difficulties given its origins, which seem, in your rather persuasive argument, to be based on a kind of bargain struck between the profession and the state? Does the problem then come just in terms of money or doctors changing their mind about whether the service is quite what they want now as against a bit more private practice?
Well, you will remember that I left the medical arena 32 years ago and have been in other and vagabond professions since then, including broadcasting. Put your question again.
Do you think that out of this extremely interesting historical and sort of experienced account of yours, where we now come to see the possibility of the service is actually a collaborative agreement between the profession and the state, that part of the problems that it might then go on to experience in later years might be, for example, that doctors would prefer a little more private area to return, having once agreed to a fairly considerable state intervention, and that therefore part of the fate of the NHS does actually depend on what doctors feel about it and not what politicians or outsiders feel, social administrators.
Well, first of all, money. I think I'm right. The first estimate I saw of the cost of this health service was 150 million. The second, I'm relying on memory now, was 220 million. What no one, I think, challenged or argued that with medicine expanding as it was, with the new drugs being discovered and the immensely expensive items they are, no one really expected this massive, inflation apart, this massive increase in public expectation and cost. No one really expected it to reach such an astronomical level. Nye argued, and it wasn't, we rather smiled at the argument, that so successful would the National Health Service be that the rate of sickness would fall, the demands on hospitals and doctors would fall, and so the cost would be less than it was estimated at first. Of course, that was all my eye and Betty Martin. Nothing of the sort has happened. And indeed, let's face it, that a free provision of everything, forgetting prescription charges, has some effect in persuading people to seek medical care. It's so intended that they otherwise wouldn't seek. The second thing, and I think it was a disease of the time, everyone seemed to fall on their knees at such words as correlation, coordination, integration. I don't think we then realized the evils of bigness, whether it be in building or the National Health Service. And one of the growing or continuing criticisms has been the weight of the administrative machine on the service. And recent steps have been taken, you know, abolishing one level. But I don't think any of us really saw ahead the astronomical increase in cost, inflation apart. And I think we tended, as a nation, to fall for the idea of organisation, administration, and so on.
Does that mean that in some sort of simple way, that we, for whatever combination of reasons, we may not actually be able to afford this extraordinary and generous kind of social policy? I mean, is that your slightly pessimistic view, as it were?
Yes, I confess I'm coming to this view. And being a pensioner, I don't have to pay for prescriptions and the like. And so this doesn't stem from a desire on my part to avoid expenditure. I think I'm coming to the view that as medicine has grown in the way it has, as costs have correspondingly risen, as there is a need for vastly expensive new apparatus, the scanning machine at, what is it, £500,000 a time, I'm beginning to doubt when any country, without weighing itself down with taxation, can assume this heavy and unlimited responsibility of providing everything for everybody, whatever they may need between birth and death. I really doubt it. I didn't start with that view, but it has grown on me. And so I didn't expect this weight of administration. I didn't expect this steeply increasing level of costs.
Again, that's most interesting. But just to finish it off, let's take drugs, clearly a huge bill. Is part of what you're describing, as it were, a reflection of the mixed economy in general? In other words, in this example, the National Health Service has to pay private drug companies enormous sums of money for the drugs that it buys. Is the problem then, as it were, that there is a public and a private mix of a kind you'd expect in the economy we have, but that the bill is footed by the public sector?
No. My view isn't as complicated as that. The amount of research that has to be undertaken by the major pharmaceutical companies is very great and very expensive. Frankly, I cannot pronounce as to whether their prices are too high. I would think the administration keeps a pretty careful look on. It is the very fact that so many of the newer drugs, or there are so many more effective drugs, and so many of them, in terms of research, are vastly expensive. And there are so many more drugs being swallowed because of the wide... You take the antibiotics, for example. I've no doubt too many antibiotics are prescribed. Well, I think of when I was a medical student, pneumonia, the crisis in pneumonia, that danger moment, the number of people who died from pneumonia, the antibiotics have virtually dealt with that situation. That's an enormous... To have a group of drugs that deal with infections in the human body without damaging the host body. After all, this goes back to 1934, when a couple of German scientists discovered Prontosil, then Mayenbaker, M&B, and now it's sprouted out. It's irresistible, that growth, and right. But it wasn't taking into account when the costs were counted.
So, just finally then, it's, as it were, too expensive. It's an enormous amount of money that goes into it, and it doesn't seem to get any less. Do you have any thoughts at all, and I know you've been, as it were, doing other things for a long time, but do you have any thoughts at all about how one might regroup or alter the structure, make it less expensive, while maintaining the, as it were, ethical point that was at the foundation of this service in the origins, that it should be an idea of public health commonly accessible to all? Is there any way of just making it work, given that it's financially top-heavy?
I'm too ill-informed. I'm no longer up to date. I think it would be useless, even impertinent of me, to provide any kind of answer to that question.
But nonetheless, thank you very much indeed. That's the real thing.